The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
And now, Sports Talk 1240.
Well, good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to Hour 1 of Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue taking you through the first hour on this Sunday night, the 30th of November, after which I'll hand it off to Eric Garment for hour number two. Our engineer Brian Graves is across the way. We've got some great guests on the lineup card for you tonight. Up first, we'll welcome in the son of the immortal Hall of Fame quarterback who has a new book out. John Unitas Jr. will join us to discuss his new book, Johnny U and Me, the man behind the golden arm. In the second half, we'll talk to Dave Buscema, who has co-authored a book called We Are the Giants, the oral history of the New York Giants. So as we finish up the big Thanksgiving holiday weekend, sit back, relax, and enjoy Sports Talk 1240 tonight on this Sunday evening. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow us on our Facebook page, most cleverly titled Sports Talk 1240. There you'll find sports information, show information, and more. So stop by, give us a look, and also, more importantly, give us a like. You can also follow us on Twitter now at Sports Talk 1240. And all past shows can be heard on our website at sportstalk1240.com. Well, my first guest is the president of the Johnny Unitas Golden Arm Education Foundation, Incorporated, Unitas Management Corporation, and Unitas Realty, LLC. As we said, his new book is titled Johnny U and Me, the man behind the golden arm. I welcome tonight to Sports Talk 1240, John Unitas Jr. John, welcome to the show.
Bill, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
It's great having you aboard. Now, we all know Johnny Unitas on the field, John. Of course, we all know him as the great Hall of Fame quarterback, the great number 19. Why did you feel that it was important to let everyone know about Johnny U, the man off the field, the dad, the parent, et cetera?
Well, you know, I'm 58 years old. I've been around a long time. Mm-hmm. In context with my father and his playing career in the Baltimore Colts and New York Giants, right in your backyard. This has been a labor of love for me, actually, Bill. It took me 3.5 years to compile and write the story. It's dedicated to both my mom, Dorothy, and my father. I just thought it would be kind of neat to for other people to see another side of my father that they didn't already know or had ideas about how it was
right.
with him growing up and being a father. I exposed the underbelly of the family a little bit and show people that, you know, my father was an everyday man for the common people you know, he was the greatest quarterback ever in my eyes, the greatest father ever in my eyes. But I thought I hear so many stories about people coming up to me on the street and telling me this and that about my dad, and I thought this would just kind of lend a little bit of another light about my father, which is all good, okay?
Sure.
So it's, again, we as fathers, me personally, I don't have a halo over my head. My father didn't. I don't know who does, but God bless you if you do. But it's another side of my father that I thought was important for people to see.
Right. And for those of you who don't have the book, we have it on a webcam here. Johnny, you and me from Triumph Sports, our friends out in Chicago.
Yep.
The foreword is by the great Raymond Berry, who we've had on the show before, John.
Sure.
And who you know quite well. Let's talk about Raymond a little bit.
Well, Raymond is he's like my second father. You know, he's been around our family for quite a long time, ever since I was little. They lived off of Shelley Road, and we lived off of Dunbeef Court in Lutherville, Timonium area, Maryland. And we knew Raymond before he was married to Sally, and then when he married Sally and had his children, we all grew up together. And, of course, was my father's go-to receiver.
Right.
And as a ball boy for the Baltimore Colts, I grew up with them, and my father and I are one dorm room. I'm on the top bunk, Dad on the bottom, and Raymond and Jimmy Orr in the other dorms next door. So I grew up with all these guys, and Raymond happens to serve as an advisory committee member on my foundation board, and rely on him a lot as it relates to football. And the quarterbacks that we have for you know, on the list of candidates to win the award each year. And so he's very instrumental, and he's just a very dear friend of the family. And we get together a couple times a year, and it's just wonderful to be around him.
Yeah, great man, Raymond Berry.
Yes, sir.
Now, John, as we say in the book, back then, different times. Different times with Johnny U. He grew up back in Pittsburgh during the Depression. He came into the league in different times. Let's talk about the different times in those days.
Well, Bill, as you know, I mean, it's football's different today. I was born in 1956, so I really didn't have the opportunity to watch the 1958 game, which set kind of football apart and from all other sports and in the media. I'm happy to be on the night of the New York Giants as well. Yes, it's just kind of a celebration of 1958 here tonight. But in any event, I just think that, you know, football back then, they only played 8 to 12 games.
Right.
You know, they didn't have the type of equipment they have today. They didn't have the food that we eat today, you know, the sustained meats and the foods and the vegetables. None of that existed back then.
No.
And these guys were just, you know, out and outright true athletes. You know, they'd smoke their cigarettes and drink their beers and go out carousing. But you know what? When it came down to practice or games, they were there and they're given 110%. And toughest guys in football, you know, they persevered. They had jobs in the off season. They certainly weren't making the kind of dough they're making today. So, you know, all that and more, social media and everything else that we have in this world today, it's just different, you know. And when you go, try to compare my father's records to Drew Brees' records or Peyton Manning's records, they just don't equate in my mind personally. But they are what they are. And my father always believed that records were made to be broken, and consequently they have been and continue to be, and I'm sure will continue to be in the future. So it's a game that these guys truly love. They truly put their heart and soul into it, and they lived in the town where they played. They socialized with the fans. They recognized that, obviously, the fans were integral in their success, both as a franchise and as individuals. And they didn't hesitate to sign an autograph or go to a local pub and have a beer or a cup of coffee at the Howard Johnson's or whatever it was. They were just everyday people, man. It was just so neat. And my life transcends that because, again, it was carefree. I could ride my skateboard and bicycle to the 7-Eleven store and not have to worry about anything, you know.
Right.
And it's just different, Bill. It really is. And I just don't think one can compare. You can compare records, I guess, to a certain degree, but you gotta look at the light it was made in. You know what I mean? It's just different.
I don't like the comparison of records either, John. I mean, the way they compare the records in baseball, like the World Series records, comparing Derek Jeter with Mickey Mantle. I mean, Mickey Mantle, his records are in the World Series.
Right.
Derek Jeter's postseason records are in how many iterations of playoffs?
Exactly.
Mantle did it in one World Series. You know, you talk about Johnny U and Drew Brees. Yeah. It's apples and oranges. It's.
Hey, it took them 50 plus years to break that.
Yeah,
record,
exactly.
You know? And Peyton's still on the course to break it even further. You know, but. But it is what it is. I mean, just different football. I mean, my father played at the time. It was hand the ball off. His dad didn't
right.
want to hand the ball off. He threw the ball, you know. And it was the same thing with Otto Graham back in then, you know, those days. And Y.A. Tittle, you know. I mean, and you grew up with all these guys.
Yeah.
You know? So it just and they're just wonderful human beings. You know, they're just, you know, there's no BS about them. There's none of that, you know.
It's just not there.
You
can't
know?
Compare the eras, John. I mean, no. These guys, they ate dirt.
When you literally, think,
yeah.
They did.
It's like that story Raymond Berry tells folks in the foreword about Johnny. His nose is bleeding. He stops, picks up some dirt, and shoves it up his nose. To stop the bleeding. I mean, it's like that famous picture of Sam Huff,
yeah.
Sam Huff with the dirt lodged in his helmet. You don't see any of that today. They'd run off and get a brand new helmet.
Yeah, or they'd sit on the sideline
yeah.
because, you know, there's a rattle a little bit, or they get an ingrown toenail, they're out for a week, you know.
Yeah.
It's different.
No, nobody's dirty in football today.
Well, there may be a few, Bill. I won't discount that. But you know what I mean? It just you know, the overall atmosphere, the overall demeanor of the players today is just so much different back then, because you know what? These guys were supporting families in the off season, having to work, and they play for fun. They play for the love of the game. I mean, my goodness, my father loved to practice. Who likes to practice, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
That's what these guys did, so they could be better. You know, they understood it. So just a different time.
The glory of the times. Now, when did you realize, John, my dad is Johnny Unitas. He's in a Mapo commercial with Mickey Mantle.
Yeah, you know? That's good. Well, you know, I guess, honestly, I grew up, you know, my father was my father. You know, he wasn't this greatest quarterback of all time. You know, he was a quarterback. I knew what he did for a living. I knew what he did in the off season too. And I knew every morning that my mom packed our brown bags for lunch, she was also packing one for my father.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, it wasn't anything out of the ordinary from a daily living life. It was just, that's just the way it was. It was just carefree and, you know, uneventful back then. This is the way it went. Dad would take all of us to Catholic schools, drop us off. He'd go to work. He'd have his brown bag. You know, he'd do his practice and off to work. If not, he was off to the steel mill. He worked at Bethlehem Steel as a pile driver. And, you know, and that's what he did. You know, he had to do it because he wasn't making enough money in football to support his family. But it was all good. You know, there were cult corrals being formed. There were organizations like any franchise has, and cheerleaders and stuff like that. And Baltimore was just a blue-collar town, Bill. Let's face it. I mean, New York was, you know, the city lights and, you know, Joe Namath and all the rest of it.
Right.
That just wasn't my pop, you know. He was just a down and dirty kind of guy, you know. He was a common man for the common people, and he loved the people here, and he lived here all his life.
Until he was traded. Now, you mentioned, John, you guys pulling up to training camp.
Yeah.
And you're a little weirded out by all the people standing around the car.
Yeah.
And it's a crowd, and they're waiting for your dad.
Yeah, it was, you know, I mean, my highlight was driving in the car with my dad with the windows down and my head out at the window. He told me to get inside. But, you know, I got up there, and, you know, I'm about 9 or 10 years old. And, you know, of course, I know who my dad is, and I've been to little functions here and there. But this was just overwhelming. We get out of the car, and there's just a plethora of people just standing there. Johnny, hey, Johnny, you, this, that. And we're just pulling up to check into the dorm, and I'm there, and I'm like, okay, what do we do, Daddy? So I just started getting the luggage together. And, of course, my father was always cognizant of where I was at the time and just basically was very kind to the people and said, listen, let me check into the dorm room, and I'll be right back out, and so forth. And so to me it was overwhelming.
Yeah.
But you know, I always knew my father had his eyeball on me and knew where I was at the time. And for me, it was a very much of a growing up period for me, you know, time to mature, time to, you know, be on your own, you know, at least try to be on your own and try to, you know, not want to be daddy's boy, you know what I mean? So all that happened. And of course we check into the dorm room, and dad comes back out and appeases his fans with autographs and talks to him and everything like that. So that was a lot. That happened to me a lot in my lifetime, which was fine. I got to get used to it.
Now, the rarity to me, John, is that he tells the people he's going to come back out, and the rarity to me compared to this day and age is he comes back out.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know what to tell you, Bill. That's just how those guys were back then. You know, I'm kind of the same way. I don't have security around me, not that I need it or anything like that. People do recognize me, and I'm very gracious and happy to talk with them. And like, I just did a book signing at the Greetings and Readings here in Baltimore. It was very nice for people to come up and talk to me and tell me stories that some I've never heard, which is really all it's about. I'm so much in love with my father and what he did and how he was a father, and same with my mom. So the more stories I hear kind of just reinforces what a great job my parents did with not only me, but my sister and my other brothers as well. So, again, it's not like our last name is Smith. It's Unitas, and
right.
You have to live up to that. And again, rightfully so, Dad earned that. That's what the players should be doing today. If they have any thinking in their mind besides the money they're making, is to think about the fans. Because once they stop coming to the game, it's over.
Right.
You know, and that's no matter what the television contract is. You know, so you really need to give back, and of course, Dad has always did that, and and I've been very blessed and fortunate to continue to do that through the Gold Arm Educational Foundation as well. So
definitely, that he did. That John Unitas always gave back to his fans.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to warn you about something, John, and I'm going to ask you about Coach Eubank, but I'm going to warn you about something that I am a Jets fan, and we're going to talk about.
You just got lucky.
Yeah.
I'm only kidding.
We're going to
play a great game.
We're going to broach a topic that I'm sure you don't want to talk about.
No, I'll talk about it right now. I'm very open.
Let's talk about Coach Eubank, because he did a great job for us here. And I know he was a favorite of your dad's.
He was. He was probably my father's favorite coach. Of course, it was his first coach. And then, of course, subsequent to that was Don McCaffrey. Well, then Shula, but we won't talk about Shula. It was Don McCaffrey that he liked.
Right.
But needless to say, Weeb was just a sweetheart. You know, he is a Hall of Famer. And he just knew the game, and he kind of allowed my father to do his thing. The same as he did with Raymond and the rest of the players. He kind of, you know, he knew the squad. He knew who was who, what they could do, and he was just he was fabulous at putting a team together, as you well know with the Jets. And he let the guys do what they needed to do. You know, he'd throw something in here and there, but if, you know, he was the kind of guy. I remember a couple stories my father told me that you know, the Colts were playing whomever and they're in the huddle, and we would send a play in, and it was for Raymond. And so my father would call the play, and Raymond's in the huddle, and he says, "John, he says, we haven't practiced that, we haven't run that play, and I'm not comfortable in running it." So my father said, "Fine, Raymond, I'll just call something else." So my father would call something else. That's how those guys were.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they didn't care what the coach sent in if they weren't comfortable with it, because they all wanted to win, they all wanted to advance and move forward. They didn't want to come backwards. So that's how they were. So subsequently, that happened quite a bit. And after a while, you know, my father would walk off the field, and Weeb says, "Well, John, I told you they'll call that play." And he says, "Well, listen, Coach." He said, "Raymond said we haven't practiced it. He wasn't familiar with it. He wasn't comfortable with it. So we call the next play." And Weeb goes, "Okay, no problem."
Okay.
So that's how it was.
Yeah.
You know, so frankly, these guys know more. I mean, they're on the field. They see what's happening. And that's what lacks today, Bill, in football. The quarterback doesn't call the plays. Some guy on the sideline or in the press box is calling the plays.
No, it comes through. Yeah, it comes a guy upstairs.
But back then, you know, you did have the guys upstairs. Don't get me wrong, but they were feeding information down to the field, and so when they got down to the field, they kind of consult with the players, which I don't think happens today, frankly. And then of course, you know, Dad already had his game plan, so if there was something that was different, then he would be told that, then he would know how to adjust for it, because he's already studied that team that he's playing with right against now the week before
right.
on film. Many a nights, my sister and I would be down in the basement Tuesday through Friday, and my father's watching film, and the projector only has a forward and a reverse. and Janice and I, my sister, would hop on my dad's lap and, you know, want to play with the projector, so my father would, you know, okay, if I say forward, you forward. If I say reverse, you reverse. But we did that a couple times, and after about 5 minutes, we got so bored. We're out of here. So then he would just continue with his scratch pad and his plays. And, you know, if they were playing the Detroit Lions the coming week, he'd be watching what they're doing and the schemes on the defense. And so my father called his own plays. But honestly, Bill, I don't think that happens today.
No.
And I tell you where it stems from, and this is one of my father's things. It stems from if you're playing prep ball, say you're 10, 15 years old. By the way, my father always said, you know, if a child has not reached puberty, you do not play football. Because if you get hurt, your bones will break and they'll heal, but they won't heal properly.
Mm-hmm.
So don't, you know, I'm not advocating 6 and 7 year olds not playing football, but that's what my father would have done.
Right.
I want to be a judge of that. But and he's right, though, because I never started playing football until I was like 14, 15 years old. And what I'm trying to get to here is that in prep ball, if you don't understand what a 4-3 or a 3-4 or whatever defense it is, if you're a quarterback, for example, I was an offensive guard my first position in football, and I love to pull and I love to crack back on people that are trying to catch my running back. But needless to say, if you don't understand all that at a younger age and someone's calling your plays, well, as you continue to mature and move forward in life in high school, someone else is calling your plays. Then you move forward in life, and you're in college, someone's doing the same thing for you.
Mm-hmm.
What are you learning?
Exactly.
You see? So by the time you get to the pros, by gosh, you are dependent, so dependent on that offensive coordinator to start talking in your ear that there's no tomorrow if he doesn't talk to you. You see? So that's the problem, I think, or an issue that I think that can be corrected, as well as proper tackling and techniques of that nature to avoid all what's happening in the Professional Football League today, that should be instituted. It should be mandatory.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and frankly, I think these guys should stay in college longer. That's my other opinion, but that's my opinion. So, because, again, what are you going to fall back on?
Exactly.
What? Are you going to be a janitor at a hospital after making $2 million, $3 million a year?
Right.
I mean, that's just what happens. And that's where a lot of these guys end up, or end up nowhere.
Right.
So it's all that stuff's important. So I'm proud of the fact that our foundation, in addition to recognizing these athletes, these quarterbacks that are playing well and they have character and integrity and aspire to the same attributes as my father, that they're also getting their education. So we're kind of twofold. We're a little different than the Heisman. And by the way, no one has ever given the Johnny Unitas Golden Arm back. So,
well, that's something to be proud of.
Yes, sir. Yes.
Definitely.
So, but anyway, I'm sorry I went off on a tangent.
That's okay. Let's take a look at Super Bowl III. I'll get you back on track.
Get me back on track, Bill.
Now, Super Bowl III, your father didn't come in until the fourth quarter.
Just a little too late.
Though. Right.
Yeah.
Now, do you think that was done intentionally?
Well... As I allude to in my story,
right.
In my book, Shula, before halftime, said to my dad, John, get ready to go in.
Right.
Earl's not playing well. We'll put you in at halftime. So halftime comes back out to the field. My father's ready to go in, and Shula says, hey, John, you know what? We're going to keep Earl in. Give him another try. And they did.
Right.
Well, they didn't put my father in until maybe a minute or two, if not sooner or later than 2 minutes in the fourth quarter. Dad comes in, takes him down the field, scores, and I'll be honest with you, Bill. I did a lot of card shows and a lot of appearances with my father, Don Maynard, you know, Sample, you know, the rest of them out there that played for the Jets. They all said the same thing, and Joe Namath said the same thing. He said, Jesus, we were frightened to death that you're going to put your father in sooner.
Yeah.
If he'd done that, it might have been a different story. And maybe it had. We'll never know, will we? But,
no.
But the bottom line is that I think, you know, my dad was hurt all that year, but he was prepared to play.
Right.
So I just can't say any different. And for my father, it was just disappointing in a sense, Bill, that because Shula was being Shula, you know.
Yeah.
You know, John, get ready to go in, blah, 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 and put you in, but we'll give Earl another try. And frankly, Earl had a wonderful season that year.
He did.
He really did, almost, you know, a Pro Bowl whole season. So nothing away from him, but there were a lot of situations in that game that would have made it a little different.
Now, what was the story with Pete Rose, Bubba Smith?
you're talking about Bubba Smith bet on the Jets.
Yes.
I don't know if you ever remember the sitcom Coach.
Right.
It was Craig T. Nelson and Jerry Van Dyke. It was a very funny sitcom. And so I happened to be watching it one day. I was managing my father at the time, and they were having a garage sale. And Greg T. Nelson's wife, I can't remember her name, very pretty lady. She's been around for a while.
Oh, Shelley Fabre?
There you go, Shelley Fabre.
Okay, yeah.
She goes, the coach comes in and you know, during the garage sale and says, how are we doing? And Shelley says, great, I just saw a pair of your high tops. And he just flips out. He says, high tops? Those were Johnny Unitas' high tops, blah, 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 blah. So watching this, I was hysterical. You know, I was just, this is funny. So I said, you know what, I have to write to the producers. So I wrote to the producers, and I said, you know, why don't we, you know, we'd love to come on the show and have my father give back those high tops to Craig T. Nelson, coach. And they loved the story, so they wrote a script. So long and short of it, my half-brother Chad, myself, and my father flew out to Los Angeles. And did an episode of Coach, and it was Dick Butkus was on the dais, and Al Michaels, and Bubba Smith, and my dad, and Jerry Van Dyke, and Craig T. Nelson. Well, we're back in the green room, and you know, while the rehearsals are going on,
uh-huh.
and so we're sitting on the sofa, and just, you know, the conversation just evolves into one after another, and the championship, the Jets game comes up. And Bubba admits to my father right there that he bet on the game. And not only did he bet on the game with the Colts, but he bet against us too. So my father was like, I can't use the language on radio, but my father's like, oh, you got to be out of your mind. Did you really? And it was the first my father ever heard of it. And I never saw my father's reaction that way. So I was like, wow. You know, now Michaels is there, and Butkus is there, and I'm like, okay. You know, so it kind of went into another conversation real quick, you know.
Unbelievable.
And I'm thinking, my
yeah.
gosh, oh my Lord, you know, we got another, you know, what's his name from Green Bay? I don't remember. Bet on the games in Green Bay. I can't remember his name.
Anyway,
needless to say.
Yeah.
That was unbelievable. That was just incredible. I don't know if he won it. I mean, what he won, what he did. We didn't get into any details. It was just the mere fact.
What a great story.
Yeah. Yeah. No, so, and there are a lot of those. I mean, there are a lot of stories where Dad was just hanging out with, you know, the Mickey Mantles and guys like that, you know, Pete Rose. I'm sure there's a lot of stuff that was going on back then that social media was, goodness gracious, I'm glad it wasn't
around. Would have had a field day with
John.
Oh, my
goodness, Bill. It would have been crazy.
Well, one great story I have to tell you that crosses the line into my next guest on the New York Giants, Pat Summerall. They were talking about the 20th anniversary of the 58 championship game. They were in Central Park. They had a touch football game between the two teams. Mm-hmm. Your dad has thrown a couple of touchdown passes, mm-hmm. and Pat Summerall says to one of the other guys, he says, 20 years ago, he says, we couldn't cover Raymond Berry 20 years ago. We can't cover him today.
Well, you know, one of Sam Huff's favorite stories.
Yeah.
He goes, he, my father's just tearing him apart, you know. And Sam gets really frustrated and angry. So he gets back in the huddle and he says, okay. He says, I'm going to call a play, but I'm going to ask you first, any of you guys have any ideas? We can't stop them. You guys, any ideas?
Okay. Yeah,
that's how those guys were back
oh,
then, man.
Man.
It was just a wonderful time. And they loved each other, although they wanted to kill each other and tear their necks off.
Oh, sure,
that's the way it was.
Let me just ask you quickly, John, before we go, what would you like to have the legacy of your dad be?
Well, I think he's already made it what it is.
Okay,
you know, he really has. It's just, you know, I my job in my life and my mantra in life right now is to continue my father's legacy with the foundation and what we do and the good things that we do and giving scholarships away to graduating high school seniors, going on to college to play football, but more importantly, to get their education. So I'm going to continue to do that. I have a son and daughter who will continue that legacy after me, and we're very proud of what we do. And Dad was just a great inspiration to a lot of people, and I hope everyone who picks the book up, they'll enjoy it, I promise you. There are some things in there that you didn't know before, but it is what it is. You know, Dad was just a common man for the everyday people, and I just thank my publisher, Triumph, and everybody. It's a really a total teamwork. It's 3.5 years of my life, and over 100 people interviewed that have great stories. And I think it's just it kind of adds to my father's legacy.
Definitely. Well, John, you did a great job. It's been an honor talking about your father and his legendary life and times with you tonight. Thanks for taking time out of your Sunday night to talk with us. The book is called Johnny, You and Me, The Man Behind the Golden Arm. It's from Triumph Books. It's available from Amazon. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Bill. Take care. Best of luck to you.
John Unitas, ladies and gentlemen. Next up, we'll talk some Giants football with Dave Buscema. Stay with us, folks.
WCBB are proud to announce the new Sports Talk 1240, along with the launch of a brand new website at sportstalk1240.com. Check out our new site for information about upcoming shows, as well as easy access to past shows, articles, our live studio webcam, and more. Of course, be sure to tune in to Sports Talk 1240 every Sunday night from 8 to 10 p.m. on AM 1240 WGBB, or visit sportstalk1240.com for ways to listen to the live broadcast online or from your iPhone. We're excited about these new changes and hope you will be too.
So you're looking for a great club but don't want to go into Manhattan or you'd like to find a new restaurant to check out, or you're buying a house here on Long Island and you'd like to find out about a certain area. Wouldn't it be nice if you could find out all the information in just one spot? Well, you can. LongIslandExchange.com. It's all you need to find out all about Long Island. LongIslandExchange.com for hotspots, classifieds, news, and more. LongIslandExchange.com is designed with only the Long Islander in mind. Get the best of Long Island. LongIslandExchange.com. Discover Long Island all over again at LongIslandExchange.com.
If you're trying to quit smoking, dipping, or chewing tobacco, you don't have to do it alone. Nicotine Anonymous is a 12-step program of recovery that meets regularly in your area. There are no dues or fees. The only requirement for membership is a desire to be free of nicotine. For information and meetings near you, call 877-TRY-NIC-A. That's 877-TRY-NICA. Or visit nicotine-anonymous.org. Let us share our experience, strength, and hope with you.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240. Check us out every Sunday night at 8 p.m. right here on AM 1240 WGBB. And visit us online at sportstalk1240.com.
Making simple changes in your everyday travel choices makes a big difference to New York's air quality. Trip chain, use mass transit, rideshare, bike, or walk. Visit cleanairny.org to learn more. Clean Air New York, breathe it in. A public service message brought to you by the New York State Department of Transportation.
And now, back to Sports Talk 1240.
All right, we're back with Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, New York. Bill Donahue with you on this Sunday evening, November 30th. That means December 1st is tomorrow, folks. We're getting there. Well, my next guest covered two of the Giants' Super Bowls. His work has been honored with several national writing awards, including a pair of mentions in the Best American Sports Writing Book Series. He's also the author of 100 Things Giant Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. I'd like to welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight Dave Buscema. Dave, good evening.
Bill, good evening. Thanks for having me. And also the new book, We Are the Giants, as well, that just came out this year. But I just enjoyed listening to your conversation with Mr. Unitas. That was a heck of a listen.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, he was a great guy. He really did a great job. Yes, the new book. The new book is called We Are the Giants, The Oral History of the New York Giants. The foreword by Wellington Mara. He did a great job with that foreword, didn't he, Dave?
Yeah, he certainly did. And it was funny when I had looked it over, because basically my role in this project was to do some updating and tweaking. My co-author, Richard Whittingham, had worked on this a while back and then in the past. And so they brought me in to turn this into a little more oral history and update some things. And as I was looking over what Wellington had told Richard, it really kind of struck me and actually reminded me of my opening to 100 Things Giants Fans Should Know and Do. And the number one for me was Wellington Mara and that story about 1925 when he's sitting there for the first time as a kid and getting introduced to football and says, gosh, that's a rough game. And it just kind of speaks to what Wellington Mara's spirit was, this kind of gentility and toughness all mixed up in one.
Definitely. Well, let's get down and talk about We Are the Giants.
Sure.
Now, the Giants, well, take a look at each of the chapters, if you will. The Giants in college, the one that struck me right off the bat was Frank Gifford in USC.
Yeah. Well, you know, Gifford had come out of Bakersfield High School. His grades were kind of low and had to go for a year at junior college and ends up at USC. And, you know, they didn't even know what to do with him because he had so many different skills and played all over the place. But his senior year, they brought in a new coach, and they basically designed the offense for him, a single wing T. And USC had a heck of a turnaround. They had not been very good the year before, but they end up having 7 wins in a row, and they later kind of fell off. But, you know, the one that really got everyone's attention and really started putting Frank Gifford into the national conversation, they beat the University of California, snapped a 39-game winning streak for them. But the other thing that's kind of interesting is, you know, the Giants' history and connection kind of helped them to get Gifford, because one of the folks on that staff was Mel Hine, a legendary Giants center from another era. And he kind of, you know, you it's the days before all this media, never mind social media. There was barely any, you know, national media.
Mm-hmm.
And so he kind of tipped off Wellington Mara, said, hey, keep an eye on Frank Gifford. And he scouts him at the East-West game in Senior Bowl. And all of a sudden you have one of the best giant running backs in their history. And it's just kind of interesting, the connection to see between eras and Mel Hine kind of tipping Wellington Mara off.
Definitely. It depicts really this book, the whole book here, folks. If you're a Giant fan, really depicts the wonderful history of the New York Giant franchise and the stages. As Dave tells you, Frank Gifford, Mel Hine, and now as we go into joining the Giants, Y.A. Tittle in 1961.
Yep. Y.A. had already been around for, I think it was his 14th year. 49ers decide to trade him, and he actually considered retiring for a couple of different reasons. As he told Richard in this, he had a groin pull the year before that had been bothering him. And as he told me in 100 Things Giants fans, you know, he also considered retiring because he didn't want to uproot his family all the way across the country.
Mm-hmm.
And he ultimately, he said, you know, I asked him how close he had been, and he said, pretty close.
Wow.
And yeah, but he ended up deciding to go for it. But he didn't bring his family with him so that they could stay settled. And then in his, his first exhibition game, because he had been trying to hide the injury from the trainers, he taped up the groin, fumbles a snap, gets kneed in the back against the Rams, and ended up being out 6 weeks because he broke a couple of bones. And that ended up allowing him the time for the groin to heal as well. And then, you know, the rest is history. He goes on to become one of the Giants' best quarterbacks. So, you know, it's kind of that time the injury may have been a blessing in disguise because it gave him time to heal all the way around.
Sure. And one of the greatest Giants of all time, Sam Huff.
Yeah, I'll tell you, he's always such a character and again, has some great stories here, and I've always enjoyed talking to him. But, you know, the really interesting thing is to think, I love origin stories, and, you know, you see Sam Huff almost, you know, here he is. He became one of the Giants' best linebackers. He almost quit his first year, and it's kind of an interesting link I make in 100 Things Giants fans. You know, everyone looks at Harry Carson as this great leader. You know, Carson almost quit twice. So it's really kind of interesting to look back at these guys that you remember with such, you know, passionate leadership. You know, they had their doubts as well. I mean, the great thing with Huff, he's about to quit. Him and his roommate, Don Chandler, the Hunter Kicker, they were having a miserable training camp. You know, Huff described himself as homesick, miserable, and, you know, because he was supposed to be a lineman, but he was too small. And later, the defensive coach, Tom Landry, would move him to linebacker, and he's, you know, later said, God, I was born to play that, and it turned it around. But before that, Vince Lombardi goes to the airport because these guys were going to go home and quit. And you know, Huff was kind of on the fence because someone had convinced him maybe to stay, but, you know, Chandler was still going, and Huff was unsure, and Lombardi pulls up in the station wagon and says, get back here. You may not make this ball club, but you're sure as heck not quitting on me now. And, you know, he tells Huff, neither are you, in case you're thinking about getting out of here. And, you know, the rest is history. And, I mean, right there you mentioned Vince Lombardi and Tom Landry and two Hall of Famers that just led the offense and the defense, but, you know, maybe one of their biggest things was helping to convince and find a home for Sam Huff just right from the start.
Mm-hmm. Another part of the storied history. I bet you a lot of Giant fans don't realize that, Dave, about that Tom Landry and Vince Lombardi came from the New York Giants.
That's kind of amazing, really.
Isn't it? Yeah.
You know, you just think about that and man, what could have been for them, too, because they lost out on both of those guys as head coaches.
Yeah.
But, you know, they really just instilled so much in that great 50s era of, you know, 56 when they win their first title. And then, you know, as John Unitas was just talking about, that unbelievable 58 championship game and the games that led up to it, which I think we'll touch base on some of those as well. But, yeah, it's just a whole heck of a lot of talent. I mean, Jim Lee Howell was the head coach then, and his biggest thing was to kind of get out of the way and delegate at that point.
Right.
So.
Amazing. Finally enjoying the Giants, we had a guy come over from the L.A. Rams, Andy Robustelli.
Yep. You know, and it's really, I mean, talk about how far we've come as well. I mean, the reason the Giants were fortunate enough to get this guy is his wife was going to have a kid, and the Rams head coach, Sid Gilman, was upset. They lost in 55, and he wanted everybody right at the start of training camp, and Robustelli told him, nope, I need at least a few days because they normally would, but he really was set on starting camp early because they'd lost in 55. He says, if you don't come, I'm getting rid of you. And so, you know, the Rams' loss was a Giants' gain. And, you know, right, I mean, you look at all these things that came together for them in you know, 56. Huff sticking around, Robustelli getting traded, and it really kind of started to build that great era for them. And, you know, Wellington Merritt had said that, you know, Robustelli, there had never been a bigger reaction in the locker room by players for the acquisition of any player, including when LT was drafted. Frank Gifford was screaming, and, you know, Sam Huff had told me in 100 Things Giants, he just, you know, he was instantly a leader, and they called him the enforcer. And there was an old quote from the old Lions quarterback, Bobby Lane, said, when Andy hits you, your bones rattle. So, you know, it's kind of a good thing for the Giants. He wanted to be such a good father.
Yeah. Outstanding. Now, we're talking to Dave Buscema, the author of We Are the Giants, The Oral History of the New York Giants. We'll move on to game time now, Dave.
Yep.
Pat Summerall, the great field goal kicker, and then the fabled field goal.
Yeah, it is such a fantastic story. You know, 1958, it's the game that helps lead the Giants to that greatest game ever played against the Colts. And they're tied with Cleveland. It's 10-10 with 2:07 left, and they were playing back at the old Yankee Stadium at that point. But, you know, there's no overtime in the regular season. And to force a one-game playoff, again with the Browns, the Giants needed to win the game outright. And here they are, too. The field is completely covered with snow. There'd been a blizzard. And one of the only times Jim Lee Howell actually, like, kind of really took things on himself, and Vince Lombardi's screaming, it's 4th and 10, let's run another play. And no, he sends Summerall out to kick. And, you know, there's kind of some dispute about how long it was. You know, some said 49. Kyle Rote insisted that, you know, the snow was covering things. It was actually a 56-yarder. In any case, Charlie Connerly, the old quarterback, is out there, and Summerall runs on, and Connerly looks at him. He says, what the bleep are you doing here?
Yeah.
And, you know, and I remember seeing a quote from Summerall saying, don't ask me. He was surprised he got sent out himself. But he says, you know, we're here to kick. And sure enough, he does it, and he gets it through the uprights, and they're jumping up and down, and Lombardi's on the sideline screaming at him, you know, you son of a, you know you can't kick it that far. And a little postscript that I enjoy from, this isn't 100 Things Giants fans, is, you know, Bob Shepard, the legendary Yankees PA announcer, also worked for the Giants for decades,
uh-huh,
was getting interviewed by, you know, Yankees broadcaster at the time, Phil Rizzuto, a long time ago. And, you know, Scooter was the Yankees' number one fan. And he asked him, you know, what's your favorite memory in Yankee Stadium? And Shepard stunned him by saying it was when Summerall kicked the winning field goal in the show, because here's Rizzuto waiting for a Yankee memory.
Uh-oh. Yeah.
And that was his favorite memory. So.
That's great. Now, how about Joe Morris in Super Bowl 21, Dave?
Yeah, I'll tell you, you know, Joe is a great source for a bunch of different stories, and he really kind of captured the spirit of that time, because, you know, it's hard. Well, it's becoming a little easier for Giants fans to recognize it now, but at the time, the Giants fans were known as long-suffering Giants fans, and had gone 30 years without a title, and, you know, there had been all the turmoil, and finally starting to turn around, but they're all getting sick of hearing long-suffering Giants fans. So it was Morris, who was such a talented, quick running back. He had some big games in the playoffs that year. But he said, you know, that was part of, you know, Coach Bill Parcells' mentality. Parcells did some gambles in that game. He went for the 4th and 1. He went for the fake punt opening the third quarter. He flea flicker, big pass to Phil McConkie that set up a Joe Morris touchdown. And eventually they ran away with it with a 39-20 win. But, you know, Morris remembered that was kind of part of what fueled Parcells to take risks. He's like, I don't want to hear this long-suffering Giants fan stuff anymore.
Yeah.
And, you know, he wanted to live with whatever decisions he made. But, you know, obviously, you remember that Super Bowl, and all you can think of is Phil Sims, 22 of 25, three touchdowns. It was just unbelievable. And Morris said, you know, he said he remembered. You know, a lot of times you see, especially in baseball, somebody comes in, throws a no-hitter, and they're like, man, they had nothing in the bullpen. And for, you know, the quarterback comparison, it was the opposite for Morris. He said Phil was having the week of his life. He said every day he was like, man, Joe, I just feel good. I just really feel good. And, you know, somebody had said to him, you know, Joe, what if the Broncos decide they're going to stop you from running the ball? He said, if they do, Phil Sims will kill them.
Yeah.
And the guy says, well, you guys are a running team. And he says, yeah, you have not seen Phil Sims play. And nobody had seen anybody play like that. I mean, the guy was nearly perfect.
Definitely, yeah. That's a great job by Joe Morris there.
Yep.
Now, you talk about Tom Coughlin with Super Bowl preparation.
Yeah. You know, I mean, and as soon as you mention Coughlin, it's just so sad to see how things are, you know, possibly winding down for him today. And
yeah, it's not. It looks like it's not going to be a pretty way out for Tom.
Yeah, I mean, what a rough thing to see for him today back in Jacksonville, and you think, oh, okay, they're going to actually get a nice win. It just becomes the worst loss of the season. But, you know, Coughlin's thoughts were just, you know, keep your eye on the prize. Have a steely-eyed focus and, you know, be efficient in your preparation and make sure your players understand when we're working, and they have some time to themselves, but you don't want any regrets. You leave everything out there. You don't want to leave anything out there. And you know, a story I remember most from their first Super Bowl is the day before the game, some players from Coughlin's first team he coached on RIT in college, I somehow got a hold of somebody and found out these guys had not spoken in 35 years, but they had such affection and admiration, even though, yeah, Coughlin was a bit hard on them, but they reunited to watch the game.
Mm-hmm.
And I got word through, you know, Pat Hanlon, the Giants PR guy, to Coughlin. And keep in mind, this is the day that Coughlin is just done with all media finally, and he can finally just get ready for that preparation. It's the biggest game of his life. And I just shot Pat an email. I said, look, I'm probably crazy to expect a comment, but I thought maybe he'd want to know about this. And, you know, Pat came back with a quote and said, you know, coach is really touched about this. Thank you. And it just goes to show the team mentality that Coughlin has tried to build all these years and what it meant to them and what it meant to him. And a week later, I got an email from Hanlon that Coughlin had wanted to send us a picture of him wearing the RIT reunion T-shirt with the Vince Lombardi trophy in his hand.
Nice. Nice yeah. Job with that, Dave. Yeah. Excellent. Now, how about the story about Justin Tuck and Strahan talking about Tom Brady laughing at Plexico Burrow's prediction?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because the thing about it is, you know, that Brady in a way had every right to laugh. You know, Plexico had made that 21-17 prediction, and then Brady says on TV, like, 17, can we have a few more points in that? Because, you know, you remember that year that the Patriots offense was ridiculous. And, you know, and Tuck said Strahan came running into the players' area, to turn the TV on, and they watched it, and when he laughed, the room got silent. And, you know, I asked Tuck, I said, it's really not that outrageous, though. Those guys scored, like, you know, a ridiculous amount of points per game. He said, no, it wasn't what he said. It said he laughed. He said it was the laugh, as if we didn't even have a shot. And the funny part is, it turned out, you know, 17 points was the wrong number. They only scored 14.
Which
would be just insane.
Yeah, that was a big motivator.
Yep.
Unbelievable, yeah. Now, the next chapter is called Giants They Were. Now, what I found interesting was the piece on Fran Tarkenton.
That was really
the scrambler.
Cool, you know?
Now,
yeah, again,
evidently,
like I said,
he didn't like that,
Dave. Yeah, you know, it's funny because like I said, a lot of this stuff was done by Mr. Whittingham before he passed, and I really enjoyed this myself because, yeah, everyone knows, you know, Fran Tarkenton, most of his fame with the Minnesota Vikings, but then he joins the Giants, and he's known for scrambling.
Right.
But, apparently he wrote a series of articles for Sports Illustrated, and he hated being called the scrambler.
Right.
He wanted to be known as a pocket passer, and he says, you know, people understand if a play breaks down, yeah, I'll do that. And, you know, so it would actually kind of tweak him, and reporters would ask him, and he'd say, you know, I'd try to say I threw from the pocket because that's my style. And the reporters would say, no, it isn't. You're a scrambler. And he said, okay, I'd say I'm a scrambler. Anything to get to the shower.
So, yeah.
Yeah, that was kind of a cool little nugget that I even kind of discovered when I saw what Richard had done.
Now we'll go back to Joe Morris, talking about Harry Carson and George Martin, two greats.
Yeah, those guys really, I mean, and I had, when I talked to those guys, I have so much respect for them. And again, Morris does a good job of kind of handling that. He says, you know, these guys, what I think people fail to realize, without good leadership, you can't have a good team. And these are the guys that have been around so long. And he said, these are our leaders. You know, he's like, Lawrence Taylor was a great, great player, but he didn't lead. He says, you know, that was Harry's job. And he said, you know, I think there are times people forget that Carson was a great linebacker before Lawrence got there, and great as a player was, he was an even better leader. And, you know, Harry was the guys you wanted to be like. And he said George would always invite people to his house. And, you know, Harry kind of took control. And, you know, you just kind of defer to Harry Carson.
Yeah. And Harry's in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, finally after.
Yeah.
Yeah, it took some time and him having to kind of, you know, he wasn't too excited about it at first, but he belongs there. Although I really do think, I mean, the other thing is you just have so much respect for Harry Carson. I mean, back even a few years ago, he's been all on top of, you know, the concussion stuff with the NFL and mm-hmm. safety. And,
right.
You know, I think he recently even said that as great as his career was, he's not sure that he would do it again, which I think is refreshingly honest and an interesting perspective because, you know, you watch these guys and then you enjoy them, but at the end of the day, there's also this kind of thing lurking that, man, this is a game and you have to weigh. Well, I mean, we're going to see it tomorrow night's another guy with Wayne Corbett of the Jets. I think there was a report that his dad wondered what price glory for him. And, man, I saw Wayne Corbett after one of his last concussions. And, oof, it's rough to watch when guys are like that.
It's a different slant on it. Sure is, Dave. Yep. I'm talking to Dave Buscema, the author, We Are the Giants, The Oral History of the New York Giants, in the Memories chapter, talking about the coach, Bill Parcells, and his happy days. It's sometimes seems funny and seems odd that Bill does have happy days, isn't it?
He could be a little intense.
Yeah.
But, no, I mean, I think Parcells has said, you know, one of the best days he ever had was when the Giants beat the Niners to reach Super Bowl 25. It was that just kind of, I mean, perfect game for him. The wild defensive game, 15-13, and, you know, they were playing with Jeff Hostetler, and, you know, he said we had our backup quarterback. San Francisco was going for a three-peat. We're on the road, and it was just pretty gratifying. And he says, you know, that flight was just one of the best times and happiest times. And he said it was just so vivid and euphoric and a party atmosphere. And, yeah, it kind of is interesting to see because, I mean, you're talking about a coach who was just known for – I mean, Joe Morris, again, in another section, it said, you know, he remembers – Parcells purposely putting a rock in his shoe so he could stay irritated during practice to get on time. And, you know, so coaches and players, the best of them have to have such a single-minded focus, they never really get to enjoy something. So it kind of is refreshing to see a guy say, hey, I really enjoyed this moment. And as soon as we got off the plane, it was back to work. But, yeah, we savored that moment.
Yeah. Bill certainly deserving of his Hall of Fame status. Going into the coaches section now, I really enjoyed the coaches chapter, Dave. Folks, this is a excellent section. Talks about guys like Steve Owen, Ali Sherman, and we'll go into, again, Tom Landry, Alex Webster, Sam Huff, and, again, the great Vince Lombardi.
Yep.
there's a section. Talk about this a bit, if you will, Dave. Tom Landry on Vince Lombardi.
I mean, just saying that right there is
amazing.
Kind of amazing, isn't it? It's just, basically Landry had said that Lombardi, I mean, obviously was the strongest disciplinarian ever seen. And, I mean, I think that reputation is wide-ranging for Lombardi. And he said, you know, he demanded so much. And Landry had said that, you know, I used to call him Mr. High-Low. He says, you know, I tell you, when his offense did well, he was sky-high. But, boy, when they didn't do well, you couldn't speak to him. And, you know,
yeah,
none of us could. You know, maybe not for 2 or 3 days. He was such a competitor, and the best thing that could have happened to him, he said, was to get the job at Green Bay, because he said Vince really needed that kind of control, and that gave him the opportunity to show how successful he could be.
Definitely. And then we have Phil Simms on Bill Parcells.
Yeah, I mean, that was always such an interesting relationship, because, you know, Parcells would get on him, and then Simms would get on his teammates sometimes when he needed to, and there's a back and forth, but... Yeah, I remember one of the interesting things Simms had said about Parcells is talking to him about leadership and making sure that he's like, I want you in that film room all the time. He says, I don't even care if you go in there and take a nap. He says, yeah, it's for the perception. You're the leader, and they need to see you doing it so that they'll do it.
Definitely. Now, we have a couple of minutes left, Dave. What I would like you to do is go – tell us a little bit about the 100 Things Every Giant Fan Should Know and Do Before They Die book. Tell us a little
that one, I mean, honestly, it's way too easy a plug, but it's usually done pretty well as a Christmas gift. It's such a nice, easy kind of thing to get out there for people. And I just handled so many different topics and all the different history. And, you know, I think these books both have some nice merit in their own ways. I mean, that one I really got to kind of tell stories and craft some of the writing for it as much as you can when you're writing about 100 things. Versus this, you're just hearing everything straight from the horse's mouth, and it's a challenge to kind of put it in an order where the story makes sense and you're just doing straight interviews and taking pieces. So, you know, I think the books complement each other very well, and, you know, hopefully people continue to enjoy them.
Sure. Okay. The books are, again, 100 Things Every Giant Fan Should Know Before They Die. That's from Triumph, as well as We Are the Giants, The Oral History of the New York Giants. And, Dave, it's been a pleasure having you with us tonight. The books are both from Triumph. They're both available from Amazon. And, again, Dave, thanks for sharing part of your Sunday night with us.
Bill, thanks so much. Enjoyed it. Have a great night.
That's Dave Buscema, folks. Well, I'd like to thank you guys for joining me tonight. I'd like to thank my guests, John Unitas Jr. and Dave Buscema, my engineer, Brian Graves. And again, you guys, thanks again. Stay tuned for Hour 2 with Eric Garment. He's up next on Sports Talk 1240. I'll be back with you on Sunday night, December 14th at 8. My guest will be former goaltender Clint Malarchuk. Till then, Bill Donahue, wishing you a good evening, folks.
Expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.